AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 335 for June 17th of 2016. Good, bad, and ugly. New cars and press trips. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Mr. Gary.
John, how are you?
I'm doing great, actually.
That's good times in the industry, I think.
Good times in the industry and for the show, because we got to let everybody know we got Scott Burgess with us now.
Hi.
And freelancer now.
Yeah, it's at Man About Town Publishing is the company that I formed.
We'll write for food.
Definitely.
And we got Chris Pockert with us, too, from CNET.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Yeah, great having you guys both here. So we should let everybody know we're doing the show in a bit reverse order. In the second half of the show, we've got an interview with Dick Ruzin that was pre-recorded. And we'll be getting to that later, and we'll talk a little bit about that now. But wanted to get into what's hot, what's going on right now, what have we been doing?
And for those who don't know Dick Ruzin, he's a former GM designer who designed many famous cars, and I think that you'll be interested in certainly sticking around to hear what he has to say about some of the cars he's worked on.
Yeah, great point. So, Chris Parker, what have you been driving lately? Where'd you just fly in from?
I'm really tired. I just flew in last night from Portugal, and I drove the new Audi A5 and the S5, the second-generation versions of those cars, and then the week before, I drove the Macan GTS, so I'm feeling very Germanic lately.
So what did you think of the Audis?
The Audis, it's a really nice...
Are you under embargo on that, or can you talk about it?
Well, so I can't talk about driving impressions, but I can talk about the vehicle itself, which, I'll be perfectly honest with you, they did an online reveal, and when I saw the online reveal a couple of weeks ago, I thought, boy, that looks an awful lot like the current car. But in person, it looks very, very different. In the same way that they sharpened up the R8 styling language, they changed a lot of things with the new car. You can see the front end and the back end. You can't see it very well in the photograph that's on the screen right now, but there are a lot of really strong character lines, both along the body side and also on the hood, and the front end is lower. It's an all-new platform, MLB Evo platform. Instead of supercharging, they've gone to turbocharging, so it's a wholly different vehicle. If you've had the chance to drive the new A4, it drives a lot like that car, and that's a great thing in my book.
And MLB, that's the all-wheel drive platform?
It's all-wheel drive only. You won't be able to get a front-wheel drive version, and it's rear-biased all-wheel drive.
Uh-huh. Interesting. So I know you can't give driving impressions. Thumbs up, thumbs down? Two thumbs up? What do you say?
Well, I'll say two things. One, I think it drives great. I think the in-car technology is superior. It handles beautifully. The engines are nice and powerful. I prefer the first-gen styling language, which is a little bit more voluptuous, a little more rounded, a little cleaner. Mm-hmm. This is a little bit fussy to me, but that's, a matter of interpretation. Some people are really going to like this. We drove through lots of small towns. We drove it on the freeway, and it was breaking necks everywhere.
Where'd you drive it? Where'd they have the launch?
The launch was in Porto, Portugal, and so we got to drive on a lot of really wonderful mountain roads and through little small towns and a little bit on the, the auto route. So we had a good mix of roads. Hmm.
And Gary, you've been driving the new Fiat 124.
Yeah, Fiat 124 Spider, which is based on the Miata, which Scott just bought a Miata. We may get to. So it's the Miata platform. Some call it the Fiata because it has the same DNA. I found the styling of the vehicle to be very interesting from the point of view of much. I mean, almost Baroque compared to the minimalism of even the new Miata. And the 124 is more powerful than the new Miata, but it's heavier. So
is it a wash?
I actually think there was an opportunity that we were in San Diego and they set up a giant autocross route at Qualcomm Stadium. And so we were able to whip the Fiat around. They'd rented a Miata, and we had to drive that on the surface streets to do the back-to-back comparison. My sense of it is that The Miata, because it's lighter, is a little more
nimble,
fun to throw around.
Tactile, yeah.
So, and this is what, a 1.4 turbo in the 124?
Yes.
And how's it respond? How's it good? You know.
Oh, they did a great job on that. There's virtually no turbo lag at all.
And yeah. One of my complaints, one of the very few complaints I've got of the current gen Miata is in the front passenger seat. There is only one passenger seat. Even me, I'm not a big guy at all, and I didn't think that there was enough leg room. Did they get any more? Because isn't the Fiat a little bit longer?
It's longer, but the length is purely fascia. I checked the dimensions. You know, the wheelbase for the two cars are exactly the same. The length is, there's about 5 inches difference. But again, it's just all decorative bits.
Yeah, which is not what you want for handling either, because it's at the extreme ends. It's, you know, you want all that mass centered.
I mean, it's just lightweight plastic. Yeah. I mean, let's face it, it's going to have a big effect.
What is it, about 100 pounds difference or something like that?
Yeah, so depending on whether you have the manual or the automatic, the curb weight for the automatic is 95 pounds different to the, Miata is 95 pounds lighter, and then in terms of the manual transmission, it's 104 pounds difference.
That's significant, actually.
It isn't a car that's that lightweight to begin with, but I would imagine the average Joe on the street is never going to notice.
Well, and the other thing, don't forget that the turbo adds weight. So the Miata is not turbocharged engine, so there is some of that. But I think part of it comes down to that when they developed the Italian car, that they wanted to add more amenities and make it.
Isn't it quieter? Isn't there a significantly more sound dampening?
Yeah, they did a whole lot of that. It is dead quiet in that car. It's eerie how quiet they made it. And
at highway speeds with the roof up, is it comfortable?
Yes.
Because that's another thing with the Miata. It's not bad, but I wouldn't want to take a long haul trip at highway speeds with the top up.
And the seats are very comfortable. And then there's an Abarth version of this vehicle as well, which boosts the horsepower by 4.
That seems nominal. But does it change the sound character of the car? Because even like the Fiat 500 Abarth sounds like a little motorboat, and it sounds great. Does the Fiata sound like that?
There's a discernible difference, but I mean it's not a whole lot.
But what I've heard is it's not at all the exhaust note of the 500 Abarth. Mm. Same engine, but not the same exhaust note.
Right, and you get more torque, so
that's never a bad thing.
It's never a bad thing.
The price point on that though is still pretty high, isn't it?
Well, you know, they've got a range of prices. You know, it starts under $30,000, and so they're saying, they're openly admitting this is basically, the second or third car in somebody's garage. This is not necessarily the first car they're going to buy. It's an Italian indulgence. And what I thought was sort of interesting was, certainly Fiat needs to have more sales in the U.S. market. And so since the Miata launched last year, it wouldn't be really fair to look at what Miata sales were for 2015. But through May sales, there were 4,495 Miatas sold, which is not a great number. And even the Fiat 500 outsold the Miata.
Well, that's a more practical car, even though it is small, right? And it's much more affordable.
More practical?
Yeah. I mean, because it's got back seats. It's got about the same trunk space. It's a more livable car on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I'd much rather have the Miata. I own one too, but
right.
It's different. And I think the problem is they've made the new Miata so much like the original, the one that you just bought, in terms of the way it feels and all of that. And a lot of us already have Miatas in our driveway, and there's really, it's a third car. We don't put a ton of miles on it every year, and you wonder, well, do I really need to get the new one to get basically the same feel and, the same emotions of driving? But I've got this car that's only got 50,000 miles in the garage. So it does perfectly fine. I don't need another car payment. And so I wonder if people are just making that decision.
Hmm. Yeah, so I spent this week driving two Jaguars, the new XE, which is, been out in Europe for, over a year now, and the F-Pace, which is Jaguar's first SUV. I call it the SUV that wasn't supposed to be, because Jag's JLR's theory was always that Jaguar will do passenger cars and Land Rover will do SUVs. And, you know, so it's a perfect brand combination. And, you know, the vast majority of their dealers are dualed anyway. But then, you know, all of a sudden the market changed and the public is walking away from passenger cars in droves and only buying crossovers and SUVs. I shouldn't say only, but increasingly so. So even Jaguar realized, you know, we got to abandon the strategy that we had. We're just going to be constantly on the sidelines here. And it's a, I wouldn't call it a groundbreaking SUV, even though it's the first one for Jag. It's really good.
What's the size?
The size is really essentially about the same as the Cadillac XT5 or the class leader, the Lexus RX. Mm-hmm. It's about the same size and about the same price as those two. And I think it'll do well for Jag, you know, because it's a growing segment. It's red hot right now. I think a lot of people who think, God, I love Jaguars, but, you know, I want an SUV. Well, boom, here's the answer to their prayers.
It'll be their number one selling vehicle.
Oh, I'll bet you're right. I'll bet you're right, and very shortly. And what I'm predicting, too, is let's call the F-Pace medium. I got to believe there's a small and a large on the way, too.
There's a small on the way. We've already seen spy photographs.
Okay.
So, I mean, and it seems pretty fully baked, so I would guess in the next 12 to 24 months, we'll know what it looks like.
Yeah. But, yeah, they had that, the U.S. media launch in the Colorado Rockies, which was actually a pretty cool place to go driving. I got a speeding ticket, though. I haven't had a speeding ticket in I don't know how long. And I got nailed but good.
The hazards of the business.
Do you have to pay on the spot?
No. He told me, he said, oh, man, you're like 30 over here. That requires a court appearance. When are you leaving the state? I said, first thing tomorrow morning. So he wrote it up for a little bit less.
Wow.
Well, that was good of him.
Thank you, officer.
I know, that's right. Thank you, I think.
30 over, that's good work you're doing.
Oh, well, look, it's big country, man.
It is.
It's big country, and they have these ridiculously low speed limits. I mean, ridiculous.
Especially near schools.
No, this is nowhere. There is no school within, you know, we're in the mountains, and I mean big open valleys. Mm. And, yeah, I mean,
so what will the F-Pace do to the sales of the sedans for Jag?
Well, you know, the sales of the sedans are nowhere anyway. I don't think it's going to put much of a dent in it. I think this F-Pace is going to bring new people into the brand more than existing Jaguar owners saying, oh, you know, I don't want my, you know, XJ anymore. I want an F-Pace. Mm-hmm. I bet they got a better shot at getting people in who are like, oh, crikey, you know, another RX Lexus, or Audi or BMW or whatever. I want something totally different. I want it to be in that same size and price and all that, but I want something different.
Jaguar's done a very good job of reestablishing that uniqueness to the brand reputation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it is a great alternative to a Lexus or a BMW or any of those other things. It just has... I think a little people all of a sudden think Jaguars are like that again, and that's great for the brand. And I agree. I think that they've already owned a RX. They've already owned a 5 or whatever. So let's move on to the next one and own an F-Pace.
I think the showroom cannibalization question is not going to be with Jag sedans. I think it's going to be somebody that comes in and looks at his Discovery Sport.
Yeah.
Because they're similarly priced, they're about the same size, and people may come in and say, yeah, I want the off-road thing, but I'm really probably not going to use it that way. And then they're going to find out that the Jag actually drives significantly better on the road than the perfectly fine Discovery Sport. And I think that's where they may run into some problems. But they say they're targeting things like the BMW X4 owners and the Macan. So maybe a little bit more aspirational, and maybe a little bit more premium than the RX and all that. So,
you know, and that's an interesting point. You know, you mentioned the Porsche Macan, and if you look at how Porsche is doing, at least in this market, is the Macan is the number one selling vehicle that they have in their showroom now, and number two is the Cayenne. And I mean, it's almost as though the car company that existed so very long of making the legendary cars is now, you know, morphing into this company that's making crossover vehicles.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, nobody wanted to do that. I mean, Porsche was almost dragged kicking and screaming But look, the market's changed. Yeah. You know, if you're just going to build passenger cars here, and what's so amazing to me is this big move, and it's a global move, and it goes from low price to luxury. It's across all segments, and it completely caught the industry flat-footed. None of the product planners really got this right. They have onesie-twosies here and there. They need a lot more crossovers in their lineups, every single brand right now. And that's the other thing that just amazes me, is that no one saw this coming.
Guy's a Jeep.
Yeah. Right. But what do you guys think about these trips? Because I got to tell you, you know, we went to Aspen, Colorado. That ain't easy to get to. You know, you got to get a connection. All told, from the time I left the office to the time I got to the hotel, took 8 hours to get there. I mean, you can fly to Europe in 8 hours.
Well, you can, or it can take you almost 24 hours to get back from Portugal, which is what it took me yesterday.
That's crazy, Chris. What do you mean, 24 hours?
Well, I had a 3:30 a.m. lobby call. This is the glamour of international travel, everyone. And in order to get back, I had to take 3 flights. So I went from Porto, Portugal, and, you know, it's about an hour drive to the airport, and then you've got
to get there 2 hours early.
You got to sit around at the airport, and then I took a flight to Frankfurt, and then I took a flight from Frankfurt to O'Hare Airport, Chicago, and you got all those layovers and whatnot. And then I had the flight to Detroit, and then I had a little bit of a drive to my house. So all in with everything, it was close to 24 hours. Now, that's unusual. Normally with Delta service, it's a lot more direct than that, but I had to fly Lufthansa. And it's just one of those wrinkles. I'm not complaining. I still had a great time. See, that was my accommodations on the plane. I'm not complaining. But it is a significant investment of time and you know, effort out of the office and all of that. And it's tiring.
I had a 4:30 pickup in San Diego last week, so your 3:30 in Europe is not that.
So, Scott, what's the ideal trip here? I mean, because some companies drag them way out and you're there a long time. Others try to do it way too short, in my opinion, at least.
Yeah, I mean, typically a 2-night program where you have you get in, you meet everybody. I would rather have the presentation on the first day. To kind of think about it, then you have a whole day of driving.
You mean the first day in, get a presentation, then the next day start driving.
All right. So for those who aren't us, who don't know what this means, is that basically the way it generally works is that we go someplace and there is a presentation, which is a marketing presentation, an engineering presentation, possibly a design presentation, and given by the people at the company. And in some cases, these are done the morning of the day after you arrive, but in some cases, as you prefer to do it the night before.
Yeah, the only reason why is I think I have more attention than I want to drive.
Well, wait a minute, because you got to explain how these things happen, because usually they have like a cocktail reception where right. All the journalists gather.
So this is the first evening.
Yeah, and you know, you start giving people some drinks, and then you want to do, like, a presentation.
Well, I would hold off on the drinks until the presentation afterwards. Is completed.
Yeah, and you're, when you say 2 nights, you're saying basically with domestics, right? You want at least probably 3 nights if you bother to go overseas.
Overseas, yeah.
Well, you know, and one of the things is everybody wants to have something more impressive. And there's competition, whether it's stated or not, between car makers on who has a more glamorous trip. The travel aside, which sounds much more glamorous than it really is, I mean, it means we get to work in really nice hotel rooms a lot of times. The things that I want are, I want 150 miles in the car of me driving. I'm disappointed with trips when I get 50 miles of driving. Mm-hmm.
See, I'm a bit opposite because, like, on this trip that I was just on, we drove at least 6 hours. I didn't get in one of the high-performance versions of the F-Pace. They have a 340 and a 380-horsepower version. I never got into 380-horsepower. I'm there bloody 6 hours driving all different kinds of vehicles, XEs and F-Paces. I want the opportunity to get in every single version. And so my preference is I want a central location with loops I can go do, short loops and long loops. Short loops might be 20 minutes. The long loops might be 2 hours. But I want to be able to come back, jump in something else. I want the manual. I want the automatic. I want the base model. I want the high volume.
But I think the commonality in here is that you want time in vehicles, and you want time to drive and to, you know, to nitpick and all those little things. And sometimes, you know, you'll fly all the way, you know, halfway around the world and get no time in the car. I've literally gone to South Africa and I've had a half an hour stuck in bumper to bumper traffic and two or three laps on a racetrack, and that's it.
Yeah, that's nice.
And it's hard for me to turn around a review in those sort of circumstances. So my thing is, you're talking about automakers wanting to outdo each other with luxury. Look, we all appreciate having a good night's sleep. I want time in the car, because increasingly we're all asked to do different things. It's not like it used to be. Not everybody uses stock photographs. Some of us have to take our own photographs or do video stand-ups or do social media and all that. That's a lot to do. So more time with the vehicle. You know, put me up in a Motel 6. I'll
still be there.
I don't care. I'll still be there. It's not about the glamour and all that. Like, just I want concentrated time with the vehicle.
Well, but another thing you guys got to take into account, though, it seems to me, now I don't know this to be a fact, but it seems to me that on these trips, that in some regards they are, and this is dubious for them, but a reward for the people who worked on the program.
Mm-hmm,
okay,
mm-hmm.
They worked on the program, so they get to go to a nice hotel.
You're
right?
Like the chief engineer.
The chief engineer, whatever, right? So these poor bastards are in places that the Motel 6, you know, makes these hotels or motels they stay in, the Motel 6 is a Ritz-Carlton. To what they did when they were developing these
in
things.
Death Valley or whatever.
So yeah, so I mean, it's part of that is the reason why I think they're there, and the other part is that oftentimes these places are accessible to good driving routes.
That's true, and.
Well, I mean, the joke is if you're going to Miami, you know the car has no dynamic capabilities.
Right.
That's exactly right.
The roads are straight and
right.
flat.
There's not going to be a turn anywhere.
And clogged with traffic. Yeah, you can tell a lot about the automaker's confidence in the vehicle by the location of the event.
Mm-hmm. You know, other thing I like is not only to be able to get in every single one of the vehicles, I love to be able to grab one of the marketing people or one of the engineers or something. Come on with me, because I got a zillion questions as I'm driving, and it's like, oh, yeah, what's this? And if you can ask them while it's fresh in your mind, while you're going through it right there and get the answer, man, that helps so much.
Although I find that when I have the engineer sitting next to me and I'm driving, that I just really want to engage more in the conversation with this person. And so it takes my attention away from what I'm supposed to be doing, which is driving.
But to your point, I like the loop setups. I've done a bunch of programs where they've done loops, and I like that a lot. Because you can decide if you want to have, you could take a person for a 20-minute ride, and then he can ride in with talk to a lot of people. If you want some of the longer rides, that works well too. And to Chris's point, when you have to shoot photos, when you have to do video, when you have to do all of that other stuff.
When you got a file.
Yeah. You can determine when you stop, when you begin. If you want to get 200 miles driving that day, it's not that hard to do. Do a couple of longer loops. And you can get a chance to look around at stuff. I mean, as much travel as I've done in the past, you know, I have a giant wall or giant map on my wall at home. And I put pins in places I go to. I don't include any automotive trips. And the reason why is I really didn't go there. I didn't really see anything.
No, that's true. And that's a great point. Everybody thinks, oh, you went to Germany. Oh, you went to, you know, wherever in the world. Oh, you stayed at this grand hotel. It's like I didn't see any of that stuff.
No, you see the life through the side window, and you know all the places that you want to come back to go back and explore. But you don't really, if you're lucky, usually you might have like 45 minutes to walk around in, you know, a morning.
And it's always cool. And, you know, I mean, right. I'm not trying to take away from it. I also like regional programs when they're here in Detroit, and I can go for the day and actually drive the car around. We'll go usually somewhere out towards Hell because those are better roads. And you can meet the executives. You can talk to them. Everything is accessible. It's a great way to really familiarize with a new vehicle.
Yeah. My least favorite are these overnight trips, like out to the coast. I hate those. I really don't want to go on them.
So fly out there, get in a car, drive.
Those
go to the hotel, get up the next morning and fly home.
And fly home. It's like
drive to the airport and fly out.
I waste so much time traveling, mm-hmm. you know, for so anyway, yeah, I hate those overnighters.
But fortunately, I think those are happening less than they used to. Like when things got in the crisis, everybody started to try and save some money.
I understand. When everyone's got to cut costs. Yeah. But to what we were talking before, if you want to do it at the Proving Ground and we got to stay at the Motel 6, I'm still going to be there.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we should all say, like, you know, we're suggesting little things or grousing here and there. We all recognize that we are tremendously privileged to do what we do.
Oh, yep.
And it is an amazing opportunity to get to drive cars that we would otherwise maybe never have the opportunity to drive, let alone afford. Or to travel and see little bits and pieces of the world that we couldn't otherwise.
Or have access to many of the people that they bring on these programs.
Yeah.
That, I mean, if you try to get on their calendars otherwise, good luck. I mean,
one thing that I've liked is that they've stopped bringing all of the top executives to the programs.
So you mean CEO level?
CEO, you know, the Mary Bears or Mark Royces.
I wouldn't mind Mark Royce.
I enjoyed getting a chance to talk to him, but I also think that it deflects away from what you're there to do. And so I actually like that you don't see that as often anymore. And that seems to be a recent change.
Mm-hmm. Hey, enough of that topic, because we got a couple of other things that we've got to get here. This weekend, 24 hours of Le Mans, you know, and this is going to be a battle royale. You know, we've had several of the people who are going to be racing there on this very show. The people who worked on the Ford GT about a month ago, we had Doug Feehan, who runs Corvette Racing, on here. But even more importantly, this is a setup because Dr. Data has a number that relates to the 24-hour.
All right. So Carmen, bring the first slide up, please. So what do we think we're looking at there?
Oh, my God. 98 horsepower, 93 mph, miles an hour. I got to believe that is the horsepower of the winning car of the first ever 24 hours, and that the speed was probably what they hit on the Mulsanne straight.
Boy, you'd win like a prize.
Is that right?
We had
is
one,
that,
yes. So bring up the second one. So here we go. This was the race. It was driven by André Lagache and René Lenard. In 1923, that was the first Le Mans. Look at that car.
And I bet 93 miles an hour with those tires
was scarier
than... Oh,
my
God. No kidding.
3-liter engine.
Big stones.
I-4.
Yeah.
Look, 93 miles an hour in 1923. That's hauling. And what's the name of that car? The Chouinard Walker?
Mm-hmm.
French. I've never even heard of that.
French vehicle.
Yeah, it sounds like a, you know, home-built special or something. But everything, I mean, the road surface, not the same. The brakes certainly weren't the same as what they
right.
are now. That's
yeah,
real
what
speed.
What was the original Mulsanne straight? Wasn't that like 4 miles long?
It was definitely longer, yeah.
And, yeah, today they've put in all these chicanes yeah. because they'd probably be hitting 400 miles an hour or something to those degrees. But
so how's Ford going to do?
You know, if I were betting my money...
We can see Chris's face on this.
Gorgeous car, but, I mean, it's really early, and it takes a lot of time to develop cars that can hold up over endurance race durations.
But they do have a win. They won at Laguna Seca. And didn't they take a second place at Spa, too, I think, already? They crashed
I'm not sure
one of their cars
yeah.
heavily there. But I think they got a second place as well. The interesting thing about the Ford GT program is the drivetrain, the engine, certainly, is a well-proven race engine. You know, they've been racing that in prototypes and the like. But, man, Corvette has got the record. You know, they've won 50% of the races that they've entered mm-hmm. since it was officially Corvette Racing doing, you know, the official team, which is an extraordinary record. And then you got Porsche, you got Ferrari, you got Aston Martin, you got BMW. I mean,
Audi.
It's a terrific category. So,
what do you think, Scott?
I don't know. It's not a big deal if the GT doesn't do much. So it's a great position to be in. So if it could place or be in the top five, I mean, that's huge. I don't know if it will. I think that, to Chris's point, that the endurance part is one of the things that you have to really look at. But, I mean, it's great that they're back in.
It's wonderful that they're back in. The car looks great.
Okay, so if they don't do well, do you think they'll go back next year?
I think they will. But over the long haul, that's the question. You know, people can come in for a few years and, you know, put together an effort and, you know, have a budget earmarked. But after 3 or 4 years, I think that's when a lot of people sort of peter out.
It ain't cheap.
No,
it's
really expensive. And I think if you look at it as purely a PR expense, that's a problem. You know what I mean? I think that those budgets come and go. But if you look at it as an engineering budget, like the way, you know, Audi, their motorsports effort, that comes out of their engineering budget, right?
Not out of marketing. That's
and
correct.
It's way different. It's just a different mindset.
What I'm hoping, I believe Ford will be back for at least the next 3 years after this. I believe it's a four-year program. I don't know that for a fact. But what I'm hoping is at the end of whatever year effort this is, that they come out with an all-new car and go for the overall win, not just the GTE Pro. That's what I'm hoping Ford's. I think they sort of woke up 3 years ago that, oh, my God, the 50th anniversary is coming up of when we won the race overall, and they won it for 4 years in a row, remember. So I'm hoping that they said that, you know, they came to their senses and said, oh, man, if we go for the overall win, it's going to cost so much more money. It's going to be so much more of an effort. Why don't we go after something where we think we've at least got a chance? And they've got a chance. They could win it. I don't think they will. My money's on Corvette just because of their past record. But I'm hoping that this is just a prelude to going after the overall win.
What do you think the odds are of that?
I agree with John. I think it's going to be a long shot for them to win. I would love to see it. It'd be a wonderful story. You know, it's a beautiful vehicle. It's a great, you know, thing that they're back in racing in this way. But I wouldn't put money on it.
What about you?
It'll win.
Gary, you put all of us on the spot. What do you think?
I don't think it'll win. Sorry, Scott. I'm a little dubious about what their commitment will be. And, you know, as you said, in order to get the overall win, that's a boatload full of money that they're going to have to put into that vehicle. And I think that with all of the changes that are going on in terms of their production vehicle programs, in terms of all the money that they're spending on software companies, all the money they're spending on developing autonomous vehicles, that, you know what, when they look at that budget for Le Mans, say, what does this get us versus, look what these other guys are doing. Maybe we ought to take some of that money and stick it into a self-driving Fusion. I think that's where they're going to go.
Yeah, no, that's good.
It's the perfect ending to a great story.
Yeah.
That they win. So I'm going to go with the win.
Okay. Hey, we've got some questions here, too, that we got to get to before we wrap up the segment. As you guys know, Ed Niedermeyer, another journalist. Who's been on the show here, too, broke the story that Tesla's got all these problems with its suspension, and they forced owners to sign this non-disclosure agreement. And if they did that, then the company would fix everything. I've never heard of any such thing being done for a repair or a warranty item. And then the whole thing blew up, thanks to Niedermeyer, that, hey, this sounds like you're not able to report this to NHTSA, that there's a potential defect in the vehicle. And just curious, what do you guys think about all this?
I interviewed Ed earlier today about this story. And the non-disclosure agreement is actually the big deal. The ball joint, it could be just one that was bad. It happens. The reason I interviewed him was to talk about the reaction from...
And bring the audience up to speed in case they haven't.
Well, Musk came out with a blog through the Tesla team that basically accused Niedermeyer of fabricating stuff for the story as well as...
Standing to gain financially.
It was the most ridiculous accusation I've ever seen. Well, Musk knows that when he puts that stuff out there, that he has this mob, this virtual mob that will do anything for him. And they just launched into relentless attacks on Niedermeyer through comment sections, through tweets, through every means possible, that they just attacked him. You know, how are you? Why? I hope you lose money on your stock that you invested. When I talked with Ed, we joked about the fact that, you know, auto journalists really don't have that much money tied up in the stock market due to what we're paid. And he even came out with a statement saying that I have never owned Tesla stock. I've never done this. It was just amazing what happened. But, you know, the column that I'm writing for Motor One is that they use all these half truths, which are really half lies, to drum up all of this stuff. And no, the NDA did not include the word NHTSA in it anywhere. It just said that you were not allowed to tell anyone, or you could face financial ruin, basically. Fines of one guy, I think, was said he could be fined up to $150,000 from Tesla. Whether or not that was intentional, or it's hard to say. You can't say that they were doing it to avoid safety recalls. But at the same time, that's what it said.
The wording was conveniently and purposefully vague, I think.
Yes.
And it's also in the manner in which things are presented to the person. So you've got somebody who has a suspension problem or any other problem with their Tesla, and the deal is they go to the dealer and it's out of warranty, and Tesla says, hey, you know, we'll cover either the entire cost or maybe half the cost to prorate it for you if you sign this piece of paper that says, you know, we just need to be protected. So if you sign here, we're going to give you thousands of dollars worth of work. And it's not something that really seems to have a lot of precedent in this business.
I've never heard of this.
Never heard of it.
But the whole notion of Tesla is unprecedented in this business. So, I mean, I think we have to take that into account.
Right.
And this thing is that nobody is being forced to sign these things. Okay, this guy had the problem, 70,000 miles, which, you know, most warranties are less than 70,000 miles, right? Right. And so he has this problem, and he goes into his local dealer, and he says, okay, we'll take care of this, but, you know, here's the deal. You got to sign this.
But who knows?
He didn't go to a local dealer. He went to a service center.
Well,
there are no local dealers to actually address those issues.
Point taken.
And who knows what was said in that conversation, because it's not on, you know, it's not written. I think it's at the very least, it's suspect. And NHTSA basically came out and said, you know, we find this agreement troublesome. So Tesla has had to revisit the language and make it a little bit more explicitly clear, like that, yes, if you have a defect, you can still report this to the government. But I think it's a little convenient and a little uncomfortable. And yes, Tesla does not operate in the manner in which a normal automaker historically has operated.
No, Tesla bullies anyone that criticizes them. There's a long record of that. And that's what they do. And the problem that Tesla is really going to run into and where this is going to hurt them is right now they're a niche car producer that makes just a 10 or 12,000, 20,000 over the course of a year. There may be 100,000 Model S's on the road. They're now saying that they want to make 500,000 cars a year. There's going to be a much different world when people are buying $40,000 Model 3s than the $120,000 Model S. Mm-hmm. I think that this is going to, it's a lack of maturity on Tesla's part. And I don't think that it's going to hold up very long when you can't attack your customers every time something goes wrong with your car.
Well, and the funny thing is, I think people have this impression that when it's a very expensive car, you have much higher expectations about quality and reliability. And I don't think that could be further from the truth.
Its interior is made from the Mercedes spare parts bin. You know, I mean, let's face facts. Consumer Reports took it off its recommended list because pieces are just falling off of the car. And one of the things that we're seeing now is the long-term reliability of Model S's is not very good. We're just now seeing cars with 60, 70,000 miles on it. They had the whole problem with their electric motors. They're replacing the bushings in that at 60,000 miles.
There are definitely issues. I think the Model S, I will still say, is a wonderful vehicle.
I like the Model S. I just want it brand new. I never want one that's used.
It's fantastic to drive. I think Tesla should be commended for pushing the industry forward into electric vehicles. I think they're really incredibly innovative companies.
Now, are you saying this out of fear that Musk might send his people not in the on league. You, or is it...
I saw them outside the studio. They were lurking in the bushes.
He's going to land one of his rockets on your head.
That's right.
See, but it doesn't matter. We all live in a hologram anyway, according to Leon. So, you know, this is all...
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of wonderful things about both their products and the company. But I think you're exactly right. There's a ton of growing up to do. And going to the mass market, I think, is going to be incredibly difficult for them. I think, you know, the expectation that the Model 3 will be available in the volumes that they're saying it's going to be available.
Or at the price.
Well, I think they'll get to the price, but I don't think they're going to get their volume targets, and I certainly don't think they're going to get their timeline targets. So if you're number 100,000 in line, you know, with your $1,000 deposit, I don't think you're going to get your car until 2020-ish.
And you're not going to get your federal rebate at that point.
You won't get your federal rebate, and you know, who knows what the health of the company is going to be at that point, because they're burning through money like crazy.
Well, if you lose money on every car you sell, you can't make it up in volume. And, you know, I mean, that's one of the problems that they face, is the places where they've made money are ZEV credits and some of these other supported ideas. So, you know, I agree. I like the Model S. I think that the interior has always been crappy. we get fooled when they put an iPad in the middle. Anytime you do that, we auto journalists really, really like that.
No, we liked it when they did it. Now everybody else is doing it. We don't like it.
Yeah,
so much.
It's not as impressive. And they have disrupted the industry in lots of good ways. I just find that this instance is just is one on a long list of times that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the way that that Musk went after Niedermeyer, and frankly, I think misaligned the story with the owner. You know, he lived at the end of a dirt road, and we needed two tow trucks to get it. The guy has come out and said, "I don't live on a dirt road. I almost never drive on dirt roads." So I think, you know, it's almost political the way he's playing it. It sounds like something more out of the current election campaign than it is automotive. And it's crazy. It really, really is.
Yeah. Well, kudos to Ed Niedermeyer for digging this all up.
Yep, absolutely.
It was good journalism. Okay, two other quick ones. Phoenix 286 wrote in to say, why doesn't FCA just drop Dodge and make Fiat the entry point?
I think it's a great idea.
Are you afraid Sergio's minions are outside reading you up?
No. Dodge is a brand that, you know, I think has lost its luster.
It's American Muscle. Come on.
I think that's about the only saving grace on it. I've always liked I think that if you want to bolster Chrysler, where there is potential to create more of a luxury brand, which would get you more money, that I would work on that.
But look,
is
Dodge,
that Fiat?
Dodge has only lost its luster. It's got nothing new. You know, where's the Durango replacement? Where's the Journey replacement? Where's finally a Dart that's halfway good? You know, all they've got is the Charger and the Challenger, essentially. That's the only thing they've put any money into. And here they've taken a brand that used to do like 600,000 plus units a year, and I don't know what it's down to right now, but they're deliberately killing it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it looks. And maybe it is, maybe it will. I don't see Dodge customers going, oh, well, I'll get a Fiat instead.
No.
And Fiat hasn't been doing any great shakes in this business anyway.
I don't want to let numbers get in the way of the story here. But for May 16, there are 43,000 Dodges sold and 3,100 Fiats.
Yeah. So what about Chrysler's?
Total Chrysler 2,400.
So there's room to grow there.
24,000.
Sorry. Yeah.
Too many.
So basically, 43 for Dodge, 24 for Chrysler, and 3 for Fiat.
But why would you get rid of
Dodge?
And why would you think Fiat would work in a volume setting in the
U.S.? Look, the market switched. The market's walked away from small entry-level cars, you know, and even though Fiat's got pseudo crossovers, they're not selling.
Well, the 500X.
Yeah, but it's not selling. Might be their best seller, but the sales of numbers are like ho-hum. Okay, one last one then. Mike wrote into... I love the Honda Ridgeline. I've written about it. We've reported about it. He says, but aren't you unhappy there is limited control of transmission shifting, low gearing, and no descent control? So none of that bothers me. You know, this is a pickup. Hill descent control, that's great for off-roading. Yes, this has capabilities, pretty good capabilities for going off-road. People who are serious off-roaders are not going to buy a Ridgeline. They're going to go out and get a Tacoma TRD.
I've got the Tacoma TRD right now.
Yeah. And that's an awesome off-road vehicle.
Mm-hmm. And my left calf is really hurting me because of that clutch. But
and, you know, so limited control of the trans. Look, I'm one of those people. I'm not into paddle shifting. You know, if I get an automatic transmission, I put it in drive, and that's why you get an automatic. So you don't have to do anything.
That's why they invented them.
And listen, I'm a guy who loves heel and toe manual transmission cars. It's not like, you know, I'm opposed to shifting, but if you got an automatic, you bought an automatic so you don't have to do all that. So, no, I still love the Ridgeline. I think this thing's going to be a home run for Honda, but I will say not in year one, not in year two. I think it's going to take 3 years for word of mouth to get out. I think year three is going to be the sweet spot for the Ridgeline.
And what is a home run in terms of volume?
Oh, that's a good question. Real good question. I would say they'd probably be happy with 40,000 first year or so, first 12 to 16 months, I think they got a chance at pushing up to 80,000 year three.
That's pretty bold, and that's still behind the Tacoma, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that'd still be behind it, right? Yeah. But for Honda, that would be a major home run.
That would be a huge home run, yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see 80. I would say 80 at the end of the second year. I think it's a complete package. One, there's tons of Ridgeline owners that have been waiting for a Ridgeline that would never have bought a Toyota or a Chevy. And two, I think that this truck just has more of a truck look and can lure in other buyers, whereas the other Ridgeline didn't. The other Ridgeline was like a fake truck.
Yeah.
And this one looks and feels more like a real
truck. Looks like a truck, drives like a car.
I don't always think that that's a good thing for a truck. I want my truck to ride like a truck.
It's a very, very rational approach to what is often an irrational segment, of purchasers. They typically are driven around with empty beds or very little in it. And they don't get taken off-road, but they have off-road suspension. So this Honda is a much more sensible product. It's, rides better, probably a little bit better fuel economy and those sorts of things. But I don't know. I'm not as bullish on the sales, even though I think that it's a very smart product. I can't say that I've driven it yet, but based on the approach and what I've read about it already, it seems like it's a well-designed, decently styled product. But I don't know that it's going to be something that shakes up the market.
Well, look, we got to wrap up this segment of the show, and we got another segment to go to. But Gary, why don't you explain to the audience what we've got coming up here?
All right, so as we indicated at the top of the show, there's a guy, Dick Rusin, who had been a longtime General Motors designer and worked all around the world for General Motors. And there's a car show that will be coming up here shortly.
The Eyes on Design show. Is it this weekend?
This weekend. And so Dick was actually, he helped orchestrate this Eyes on Design, and he'd gotten a hold of Jack Telnak and Chuck Jordan.
Former head of design at Ford and Tom Gale,
and got these guys together and said, hey, let's put on really a show that's dedicated to design. And so one of the vehicles that will be at that show is the Bitter CD, which Dick was instrumental in designing over in Germany. And this vehicle, interestingly enough, and as you'll learn, was basically predicated on a design that Dick had done for a Vega-based Oldsmobile Coupe. Is that right?
Yeah.
So he's a very interesting guy, and he talks about his Mangusta that he'd owned that used to be owned by Chuck Jordan. There's a lot of interesting stuff in what he has to say. So I strongly urge you guys to all stay online.
I can't wait to meet him.
He'll be in Chris's chair.
Okay, and with that,
I'll be in your chair.
We got a Chip is telling us something here. What?
Please apologize to Jonathan Brown. He called in. The computer ate his call.
Oh, Jonathan, I don't know if you heard that. We apologize. I know that you had called in with a phone call, but the computer done ate the call. So sorry about that. Save the question for next week. We'll get to it then. Right now, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll come back with that segment with Dick Rusin.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. We've got Dick Rusin in the studio with us right now. And Dick, great to have you here on AutoLine After Hours.
Thank you.
So just so the audience tuning in, I know we talked a little bit about it, but just give us a quick thumbnail of what you've done in your career here.
Well, I graduated from Michigan State in 1959, went to work for Fisher Body. I couldn't get into design. And then 2.5 years later, I managed to get in there. I worked in Oldsmobile Studio on the first Toronado and a number of other cars. And then I went off to a great place called Preliminary Design, where it was kind of like a think tank, and they did a lot of scale models. So I had an opportunity to do a lot of cars in there completely myself in scale form. And then I worked around the building in different studios, and in 1971 was sent to Germany to work at Opel Design for 6 months. Then after that, became chief designer and ran my own studios, and I was the studio that created the X cars. We had a big room, and we did a lot of cars. We had to sell the concept to the corporation. From there, I went to Chevy 2, which there were three Chevrolet studios, and Chevy 2 was the one that did the small cars and all the high-volume sedans. So we did those cars. I was there for about 8 years, and then was moved to Cadillac Studio and the 92 Seville, the Eldorado, later DeVille, and the Fleetwood, all the 4.5 years of those cars. And then they sent me to Germany again, and I was there for almost 5 years as director of design GM Europe. Then I came back to the States for 3 years as director of design for Chevrolet, and then I had a chance to retire early, and I did.
And you also got this car show going that's coming up this weekend, what they call Eyes on Design.
Right.
And you're the guy who started this. So give us a little bit of the thinking, because it's different from other classic car shows. In fact, it's really not a classic car show in a sense, is it?
No. In fact, they've wandered a little bit from the roots. My wife was a reader. There's a charity that lives near us, that has their offices near us, they do different things for the blind, Detroit Institute of Ophthalmology. And my wife was a reader. She would read the local paper. Blind people can get news, national news, you know, local, big local news, but they can't get any news from their community, but it's in the newspaper. So what they would do then is they would have somebody read, they had a whole team of people reading different parts of the paper, tape it, take it back. This is overnight. Somebody would convert it all to a tape and then bring it out to people who were blind, who couldn't. And that's how they got their local news. Mm-hmm. So my wife was a reader, and she had a newsletter, and it said they wanted to do a car show. So I said, well, I can put my Mangusta in the show. So I called up, and they were in very early stages. They had an idea that they wanted to do a show. They were going to do it behind their building. They had room for about 20 cars. And I said, well, you know, there's another show on the other side of town called Meadowbrook that they have 200 cars, and they're a national force. They didn't know about it. So anyway, I put together a concept for them, and we had 6 weeks. And the ladies that ran that, they were very good at doing cake sales, parties, all that kind of stuff. They were really good at it. And so I was the only one. So I gave them really good direction. And I went out and I had one of the designers had a beautiful sketch of a contemporary car with an old Rolls Royce in the background. And I got that as a poster. And I went out and put flyers in as many cars as I could. And we got 100 cars. We had it at Grosse Pointe Academy, the first one. We had it there for 2 years. And that was the beginning. And the first year they made money like they never thought they would. So they decided to adopt it and really go for it.
But explain the concept. Yeah, sorry, Gary.
I was going to say, so this is to go for the Detroit Institute of Ophthalmology to help people like your wife doing the reading and so on.
Yeah. So that was that's how I got to them, was through her. My idea was not to do a classic car show as Meadowbrook was, but to do a design show. Nobody was doing a design show.
Explain what you mean by that, a design
show. Yeah, here we were in Detroit, and we had the three major car design studios in Detroit. We had the huge design profession, and the idea was to get them together. So I called up, I talked to Chuck Jordan. I was in Cadillac Studio at the time. I talked to Chuck Jordan about what I wanted to do, and he said, great, we'll give you 4 cars.
And he was running GM Design at the time.
He was the VP of design. And so he said, The idea was to take the concept cars that you see in at the Detroit show and have them outside on the grass for people to see, like real cars. And then have classes, you know, traditional concours classes, but everything focused on design. Everything, the program, the artwork, the poster, everything is design-oriented.
In other words, you were not necessarily looking for concours-quality cars that have been immaculately restored.
I wrote...
You were basing it... You wanted a car in the show based on just the design of the car.
I wrote all the rules. I wrote all the judging rules. We got a great guy from Chrysler, Jeff Godchill, who stayed and did it for like 25 years. But I wrote all that stuff. I did the whole concept. The idea was it was a design show. Everything was focused on design. And we had a Jeep in the first show, and everybody said, why would you have a Jeep in a car show? It makes no sense at all. So
you're talking about the original 1943, whatever, Willys,
it was,
right?
You're
not talking Grand Cherokee.
No, it was the original Jeep concept, those vehicles. The focus was on design, so everything had to pass through a design filter. High quality, the logos, the artwork, the tickets, everything. Designers were involved in all the different activities, like the brunch. There was a brunch which exists today still. There was a designer in charge of that. And the idea was, and what I did was I put together a little concept of it and sent it around to Ford, Chrysler, and GM. The idea was to have the design management choose young people, designer or assistant chief designer, and get this added experience of running this unusual kind of thing all on his own or her own. And so that went along great for a number of years. And was very successful.
Did you put your Mangusta in the first show?
Yeah, the Mangusta was in the first show, and Larry Erickson had one of the classes. He was working for me in Cadillac Studio at the time. I had the Mangusta in the show.
See, and his Mangusta had been Bill Mitchell's Mangusta. He ended up buying it in a blind auction, in effect.
Yeah, they had to sell cars at that time that they had purchased for evaluation.
Explain that a little bit, because I think a lot of people don't realize that car companies buy a lot of competitor cars.
Yeah, and through the years, they evolve how they handle them, how they test them, how they get rid of them, okay?
Some are torn down to pieces, right?
Yeah, and some are crushed to gain the knowledge, the structural knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So they have programmed for that.
But some beautiful cars happen to make it through the whole process intact.
At that time, they'd sell them. And the way they sold them is they brought three dealers in, give us a price, and then they took the highest price and offered it to interested employees. There were three of us that put our name in to buy it. And I couldn't go. We were doing a show for Ed Cole, and I couldn't go. And I got a phone call, and a young woman in purchasing said, we're going to have a drawing. There are three of you. She said, we're going to have a drawing to see who gets the car. I said, what car? My mind was somewhere else. She said, the Mangusta. I said, oh, yeah, I forgot. I put my name in. Okay, so I said, she said, can you come at 2 o'clock? I said, I can't come at 2 o'clock. Can I be the one that's left in the hat? And she said, sure. And she said, the one that's left in the hat's going to get the car. I said, whatever. So I hung up. And I was really more of a mind to want to participate, to have a chance to get it, not necessarily thinking I could really get it or I would want to really get it because I didn't have the money.
But I heard that you could get these cars at killer prices.
It was, but it's still
more money than you had.
He had to go home and tell his wife that he was buying this car and she was not on. But I thought it was interesting, you know, as you said, that they bought cars. And so what I thought was interesting, the story that you had told when you were writing about your vehicle, that Bill Mitchell had gone to Italy to the Turin show, and much to the chagrin of the in-house accountants at design staff, he came back with three cars, the Mangusta, a Maserati Ghibli, and a Lamborghini Espada.
Wow.
But all three. And he promised those Italian engineers that had quit Ferrari, I think they were engine engineers and were building their own car, ATS, he promised he would buy one from them. So he comes back in the show was in October. So he comes back, and then around January, a Maserati appears, yellow Ghibli, beautiful car. And then right after that, a silver Espada. I had a chance to ride in it once. Just gorgeous. Silver exterior, silver interior. Beautiful car. 12-cylinder engine. Huge engine and transmission. You know, as big as that car is, the engine transmission was huge. And then in May, the Mangusta came. Well, the Mangusta came very late because I figured out after they made the custom air cleaner, which had to be reversed compared to the Ford air cleaner.
Because they had a Chevy engine in it.
Yeah. After they made the air cleaner, somebody stole the carburetor. A big Rochester four-barrel, right? Quadrajet.
So this was stolen out of, like, the design studio?
No, Di Tommaso.
Oh,
Di Tommaso.
Oh.
It's stolen in Italy.
Oh.
So they never could drive it. So they sent it over, and it came by plane. And apparently, we figured this out, what they did, since it was coming, they didn't want it to jounce, so they tightened all the suspension, but they didn't tell anybody. So the car gets here at the tech center, and they got another carburetor from Chevrolet, and a good friend of mine was in charge of those cars. His name was Doug Patterson. He was from Chrysler. He had run the Chrysler racing program, and when all that stopped, design hired him because he was really an aerodynamicist. And we were starting big aero programs, and I was, our studio was the one that started, and we went to Pasadena a lot, and Doug, you know, Doug ran that. So I knew him very well, and he was in charge of Mitchell's special cars. So they got another carburetor, and they got it running, and then people drove it. Finally, Bill Mitchell drove it, and this show cars of those days, if you look at the old pictures, the seat backs are vertical. So this car had vertical seat backs, and the suspension was all tied down. They had ripped a tire, taking it into a studio on one of the platforms, so they put glass belt tires on it, which had straight vertical sidewalls. So it rode like a stone. And he drove it once around the lake. He was so upset the way it rode, the way he sat in it, the fact that his head was right up against the windshield and the rearview mirror was back here, and he was really mad about it. Well, then Henry Hager was doing mid-engine Corvettes. In fact, there were two or three going on, and DeLorean was head of Chevrolet, and every time they would take the mid-engine Corvette out to show DeLorean, he'd say, "Get the Mangusta." And it was a very unfair comparison because, you know, the Mangusta headlights were 4 inches low and there were just all kinds of things that you couldn't. It was not a good comparison. It was a good vision for design, but it had so many advantages that it was a bad comparison.
Is that because they didn't have to have the same regulatory issues that you guys were facing?
They just did what they wanted.
So you said that the windshield is sloped 68 degrees.
68 degrees was the fastest windshield in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all told, if you get past 65 degrees, you won't be able to see. Mm-hmm. And here it was, 69 degrees, and I'm driving behind it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of things like that on the Mangusta. So Bill decided to sell it. There were complaints. Henry complained. So he said, okay, we'll send it to the warehouse. They sent it to the warehouse. It was over there. So when DeLorean asked for it, it was gone. It was away, just across 12 Mile.
Now, when you said that he drove it around the lake, this is the big pond at the tech center.
Yeah.
So that is the extent to which Bill Mitchell had driven this thing.
He drove it.
And can you imagine that, you know, he spends all this money on buying this car and he just drives it? You know, what would that be, like a mile and a half maybe?
Oh, not even probably.
Yeah, and that's crazy.
Yeah.
But now that car had some influence on the car that when you went to Germany and got involved.
Oh, it had influence on a lot of cars all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
When that car came out, if you imagine, before the Mangusta, cars were quite round. There were the heavy forms. Think 65, 66, 67, emerging from the 50s, slowly step. And then all of a sudden comes these two cars, the Ghibli and the Mangusta. And because they're so low, they're reflecting things that regular cars don't reflect. They look like mirrors. You're looking at the hood, and it's like a red mirror, like on my car. And so what happened was you could look at a lot of cars of that era, and you'll see the influence. The 71 Camaro had the sharp brake line with very extreme tuck under. The taillights on the Camaro and the Firebirds, the Mongoose was in the garage. They were looking for how to finish off their quarters. But it influenced a lot of cars. And there were a lot of cars that followed it, Italian special cars, that imitated it. But no one ever did it as well as Giugiaro.
Giugiaro did both those cars, the Mangusta and...
Yeah, at that Turin show, he did the Mangusta, he did the Ghibli, and two or three other cars that were in that Turin show. Yeah.
What designer these days has multiple cars in a show? Anybody? Probably not anymore.
No, right? Not any. In the Mangusta, he had done a car called the Fidia, four-door sedan, for Bizzarrini. And he, at that time, had left Ghia. He was wanting to start his own company. He's freelancing, so he's thinking, what can I do? I have to make something happen. So he proposed a mid-engine partner to the Fidia. The Fidia had the sharp, flat surfaces, the sharp lines. And so he proposed a companion to the Fidia as a two-passenger mid-engine sports car because he had worked on the Miura before he left Bertone. So he knew all that, how that worked. And so he's at home, and he makes a four-view drawing of the Mangusta and takes it into Ghia. Di Tommaso is in the buying process. I don't know exactly where they were, but Di Tommaso was buying Ghia at that time. And so they somehow it went from a drawing to a full-size model. I think it was fiberglass model. And Di Tommaso buys the company. His brother-in-law's getting him the money. He buys the company, and he has a failed chassis project that he had worked on with Carroll Shelby called the P70. And it was a race car chassis they were going to sell to whoever wanted a race. It was designed around small block engine, small block Chevrolet, small block Ford. The only problem was just before they finished, Chevrolet came out with the big block. All the prototype sports racing went out the window, and it was the Chevrolet big block that took over. So their chassis was dead. Okay, he has it. So he buys Ghia. He's got the chassis. Here's the body from Giugiaro. 4 months later, he puts it in the two pieces in the Turin show, and he says, I'm putting these two cars together, and I'm going to put a car on the road, and it's going to be called the Mangusta.
Hmm. So now, talking of chassis, so when you went to Europe in 1971, just shortly after getting the Mangusta, you went with a drawing of a car, which I think is phenomenal, that had been the Oldsmobile version of a Vega.
Before I left, I was working in a great place called Overseas Studio, and we were relating to the studios in Brazil, Australia, Germany, England, and we were doing projects for the United States, and we got a project to do an Oldsmobile, and I had been in Oldsmobile several years earlier, worked on the Tornado and all those cars up until the 67s. And so we got a project. And the project was do a sport coupe, small sport coupe, off of the Vega platform. So we did this little car. It was a beautiful little car. It was called Oldsmobile 888, 888. And that car was done. When I left, I had some sketches. I took one sketch with me. And shortly before I left, the project was canceled. Here's the sketch.
There's the sketch, yeah.
Yeah, shortly before
the... sure don't look like no Vega to me.
No, because it was not supposed to look like a Vega. It was supposed to look different. In fact, I think probably one of the reasons it was canceled was it probably looked too good. It looked really good. We had our clay model was red. I did the side, and another designer came named Dennis Wright, who had worked on the Chaparrals with Larry Shinoda. He did the front and the back, and we had the headlights looking like Mercedes. They looked like, you know, they were flush with the body with a a big round lamp inside of it. But anyway, we did that car. It was red. It looked great. And then shortly before I left, it got canceled. So I took this sketch with me.
And so you go to Germany, and there's a German race car driver, Eric Bitter, who had gone to Opel and said, I want you to develop a car for me based on the Diplomat platform.
Right. Now, the whole collection there of influences, Bob Lutz was the head of marketing for Germany, not for all of Europe, for Germany only. He was a young guy in his early 30s, and Eric Bitter was in his early 30s, Dave Holes. We were all about the same age. George Galleon was there, a great guy, great designer. And so 6 months after I got there, I was there 5 months. I'm getting ready. This is going to be my last experience, 1 month. And so Dave said, I want to put you in, he had put me in an interior studio, and he said, you'll never get another chance to work on interior, so spend a little time in there and, you know, learn about all that. I said, great. Because for me, it was supposed to be a learning experience. So I was there, and I did an interior, and I put little emblems on the tach and the speedometer like the Mangusta had, but they were Opel emblems, and door handles like the Mangusta, and some other little details to make really give it kind of an Italian sporty look. This was the interior. I just remembered this the other day. I kept looking at the emblems on the Bitter and thinking, where did that come from? There was something about it. Anyway, he took me from there and put me in Herb Kilmer's studio. Herb Kilmer was a wonderful German designer. He embodied everything classy and elegant about German design, and he was doing the big cars. So Herb was in there, and another designer, Hideo Kadama, was in there, first Japanese designer hired by a European company. And then there were a couple more guys. And I was in there about a week, and Dave came in and said, we got a special project. We're going to do a low coupe off the Diplomat platform. Well, he knew about that earlier. He knew about that maybe 2-3 weeks before. But finally it happened. They got the approval. And somehow Eric Bitter had, probably Bob Lutz had some influence, talked people into doing a special bodied car off the Opel Diplomat chassis, which was an excellent chassis. It had a lot of accolades from the German magazines. It was really good. And so here's this car now on this excellent chassis. And I'm sure the Opel, whoever was in charge of Opel, can't remember his name now, but I'm sure the direction was, do a great-looking car. We don't want him out there, Bitter, with a car that isn't really good-looking. If he's going to have our platform, it's got to be good-looking. So we get this assignment. We have 1 month to create a theme for this car.
Not a lot of time.
Not a lot of time at all. About one-fifth the time you would normally spend if you were doing something fast. So I put my sketch up, and everybody went through their drawers and found 2-3 things and put them up. Hopefully there might be some clues there about what to do. And the next morning, Dave came in and looked around. He said, here, take this one, the red one, the red sketch you just saw.
Of the Oldsmobile.
Of the Oldsmobile. Yeah, he doesn't care.
The 888, yeah. Right.
The Oldsmobile's gone. It's gone. And he said, start a scale model on this. Well, what he was doing, you know, I've been in the same situation. What he was doing is he wanted to get started, okay? And there were a few pieces there that looked good. It would be a good start. And so, they were already making little foam bucks so we can start these little scale models with mirrors in the middle. So you had two sides, and there were two of them, so four sides. So I got started really quickly with this thing, got going very quickly, and he picked a couple more, so they got started. And a couple days later, he came back, and it was coming along great. In the meantime, I didn't want it to look like the Oldsmobile. I mean, it didn't look European. The Oldsmobile didn't. So I was working on the body side, and I'd created another sketch. That's the kind of maroon and green one. And that was going to be, the one on the top there. I had created that sketch with this high tail and the DLO still, the glass line still climbing into the quarter and the thin roof. And I had that, and I was going to have this soft shoulder on the side where you see that dark red color. And to do that on a clay model, what you first do is you create a hard line. And so we created a hard line sculpture. We put that in. We got the attitude right. And we're just getting ready to roll it off, and Dave came by and looked at it.
And when you mean roll it off, you mean just sort of get rid of that hard line.
Get rid of the hard part of it so you just have the shoulder. The highlight, the horizon line, would be in the same place as it was if it were hard. But instead of being hard, it's a softer shoulder. So Dave came in and looked at it, and he said, that looks great. I said, well, we're going to roll this off now like my sketch. He said, no, don't do that. Leave it just like that. Perfect. And I said, well, I'll have to put some kind of wheel ups. He said, well, just make them like the Mangusta. So, okay, so I did that. So then, at that point in time, we had the roof, we had the belt line, we had the quarter, we had the wheel ups, we had the heartbreak in the side, and that was the car. So we then, a couple days later, we're working on it, and Eric Bitter came by. And Eric was, every time he came, he brought little sketches. Now, Eric wasn't a designer. He was an engineer. But he was doing these little sketches to show Dave what he thought should happen. So you can imagine, this is a real... he's the guy that owns the project, right? And Dave always... It was a great lesson. Dave always treated him and the sketches with greatest respect. He looked at everything. He talked about what he was being shown or whatever. You can imagine who's going to walk in the door with sketches in a professional design organization that's been running for years, with people who have been doing it for years, and have something that is going to blow them away. You know, it's probably not going to happen. And so, anyway, Dave always looked at everything Eric had with great respect, and there was a lot of discussion, and he convinced Eric that the car should look Italian. Because the highlights of design at that time still were the Ghibli and the Mangusta. So it should look Italian. And so Eric kind of went along with that. Well, then when he saw what we were doing, he got excited. And that was it. So then the next 2.5-3 weeks we spent refining our models. And then after about 2 weeks, mine was chosen and all the effort was put on mine. The rest of them went away. And I remember at the time there was, it's really interesting how long it takes some technologies to emerge. One of the things that had to be done, the car, Dave wanted hard top glass. That was the big American thing. Hard top glass like convertibles, you know, no door frame. Well, if you're in a car that goes fast, that glass is wanting to tip out.
You get wind noise.
You get, you're going along, everything's fine. You reach a certain speed, and all of a sudden the glass pops. You get this huge noise sound of the glass, of the air leaving the compartment, passenger compartment. And so this company had come up with this idea of have a little electric motor, and so you can have a channel for the glass like this, and when you shut the door, the glass goes up. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we were trying to do that on this car, and the engineer, the studio engineer, you know, he was working on that with this company. Well, it didn't happen. It took another 20 years for that to happen.
Right.
Every car you see now, any kind of coupe, convertible,
all have it.
Right. They all have it, and it's because now technically or it's electronically it's capable of happening. But anyway, that went away. But the other significant thing, I was drawing the hatchback on this scale model. It was clay, and I was drawing with a knife, and Dave came by. And so I had these lines, and he said, what are those lines? I said, well, that's the frame. He said, well, you don't need a frame. I said, you mean just a piece of glass without a frame? He said, yeah. Why not? I said, I don't know. So we left the frame off. Well, the previous concept car, this one that Chuck Jordan did, the Astra CD, done about 2.5 years earlier,
also in Germany.
Yeah, also had a frame, a frameless hatchback, glass. It had a lot of shape in it, but didn't have a frame. So anyway, that turned out to be a very significant part of the design. But so I'm supposed to go in first, I think, November 29 or something like that. And so I told Dave, I said, you know, I'm going to be going tomorrow. He says, no, you can't go. I want you to stay another week. Well, you know, everything is all set up. My family, the flights, all my stuff is packed. So I stayed another week. He said, I want you to work on the front and the back. He said, you should do that because you'll be glad you did that. And what he was trying to do, Dave had a real sense of history. And I think he even said something about it. What he was trying to do is to get me to really identify with the car as a single effort, as mine, even though there were other people involved. And I left the scale model, of course, and I went home and forgot about it because I was working on other things. And so what happened then, they took the scale model, and I think it was sent to Bauer. Bauer made a full-size hard model of some kind. They sent that back to Opel Design. I've seen pictures of that. And Opel Design kept working on the details. The guys in the studio, George Gallion, Herb Kilmer, Hideo, Dave, whatever. And they finalized it and then sent it back. And Bauer, I'm sure, was involved in that. They'd come down and see what they were doing, make sure they could do it. And then that was the end of it, and it went and was produced.
So the bidder, and 395 of these cars were made.
Originally, they were going to, I am pretty sure originally they were going to be 1,200. Mm-hmm. They showed the car at the Frankfurt show. They got huge reviews, rave reviews, and he took 200 orders, which was unbelievable. And then 3 months later, the gas crisis hit, and he lost all his orders, and he was like, here I have a car that's not fuel efficient. Who's going to buy it? And so they reconfigured the engine a little bit and did some things to try to increase the fuel economy. And he built them, sold them till maybe 1980. The one I have is a 79. And
well, you got to be very pleased that you actually own one of these.
Yeah, I never thought of buying it.
Do you know how many are in the United States?
Yeah, 5.
So including yours, or
yeah.
So, and that's it?
That's it.
And so are you going to have it at Eyes on Design?
Yeah.
So anybody who wants to see this car that happens to live in the Detroit area or, you know, could drive up if you're – or down, because we've got a lot of Canadians who listen to the show as well, they'll be able to see it at the Eyes on Design show.
Yeah, I think it's in European sports class.
Mm-hmm.
It's the people who I bought it from liked cars, but they didn't know anything about cars. I know that's hard to understand, but it was pretty clear with what I found. They had all the work done on this car. It spent most of its life in California. Mm-hmm. Came from Europe after a couple of years to Florida for a couple of years, and then to California. And it stayed there the rest of its life till I bought it 3 years ago. But they had a lot of things done, and they didn't know what good work was or bad work. They just accepted everything. So I've spent all this time fixing everything.
Mm-hmm. And you would know exactly how it's got to be fixed.
But the guy had very good sense of design. He picked the perfect wheels that were period wheels, the cross-lace wheel that was a development of the Chaparral wheel, where Bill Mitchell told Larry Shinoda, just make it look like a wire wheel, and he left the room. And that became the lightest, strongest, first wheel that was modular ever created. And Larry Shinoda did that. And so those wheels are on the car. They put a new Chevy engine in it. They put a relatively recent 350 horsepower engine. The original car had 225. Hmm. And they had it painted a beautiful pearlescent amethyst purple, which most of the time it looks like a black car till you get the sun just right, and then it's this beautiful reddish purple blue. Mm-hmm. The interior is original except for the seats, front seats, blue, and in unbelievable original shape, because the guy was, I think he didn't have any kids, or his kids were older, and they never were in the car. Nobody was ever in the car.
Wow. That's great. It's great to know that it's in such good condition. And again, you know, anybody who's in the area can get a chance to look at it.
But yeah, they're going to have, I think, 300 cars this year. I just read the assessment in the Grosse Pointe News, and they're going to have a lot of cars. So is St. John's. They're going to have almost 300 cars this year. Well, so there'll be a lot to see.
With that, we're going to have to wrap this up. But Dick Rosen, thanks so much for stopping by and sharing all this knowledge with us.
I hope you can fit some of it into the program.
That's right. Real good. So, Gary, next week, you're on your own.
I am.
I'm going to be on vacation.
Well, I won't be on my own. We're going to have a journalist panel extraordinaire.
Okay. Real good. But you'll be in the driver's seat.
Indeed.
Completely on your own in that one. Okay. So, good. Want to thank you guys for being here, and of course, want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.